Thank you for coming. I'm Karen Malpete, and I wrote and directed the play Prophecy. And that's not why I said that, just so you would know who I was, because it's really my profound pleasure to introduce Professor Noam Chomsky, author, teacher, linguist, preeminent intellectual and moral voice of our time. Noam Chomsky knows more about the causes and effects of American imperialism than any other person alive, and certainly far more than anyone in the government. So right now, when we need someone capable of cutting through the cant and speaking truth to power, we are graced with his fierce and rigorous and gentle voice. And I particularly want to thank Noam for his generosity in supporting Theater 3 Collaborative, a little tiny theater trying to put on a play about the effects of war that no established theater in this country dared to produce. When I wrote Noam the story of how we realized that we would have to do the play ourselves, he answered, "Why am I not surprised?" And he agreed to help. It's always been my dream that the theater become again a vital part of the intellectual life of its time. And it's a very great honor for the theater as a whole to welcome Noam Chomsky to the stage tonight.
Does this work?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that we moved to a different auditorium, frankly. I thought I could shake off a little bit the emotions and the memories that were brought up by the performance a little bit, not too much. One thing that couldn't help coming to my mind as I was watching it, that I don't want to spend time on personal things, but I've had about 75 years of consciousness of the outside world, and I don't think there's been a moment when, at least in the background and often obsessively in the foreground, was the thought that we've got to do something to stop this horrific war. Too many of them to mention. And they're going to go on. They're going to go on. We can see them developing right in front of our eyes unless we do something about it. I'll say a couple of words about that and then turn to you and see what's on your minds. I just happened to have come back from Lebanon a couple of days ago. I was there 4 years, exactly 4 years ago with my wife. We traveled through southern Lebanon, met lots of people. We were graciously welcomed in homes. I gave talks, met lots of people, you know, saw the country. It was a moment of real hope. It's had a terrible history, but that was a moment of great hopefulness and aspiration for a better future. A couple of weeks after we left, the place was leveled. That was the U.S.-Israeli war. They operate in tandem. The U.S.-Israeli war, which essentially leveled the southern part of the country. This time, of course, I went back to try to see the places where we had been, the places where we had been welcomed, the people we had met, some of them now murdered. Places like Nadahya in southern South Beirut, which was literally leveled. That's the famous Dahya doctrine that an Israeli general proposed for Gaza a couple of years later. A lot of it's been rebuilt, amazingly rebuilt. There's still a spirit of courage and determination, but my sense is of more grimness than there was before because of an expectation that it's going to happen again, and it might. I spoke to I don't want to mention any names, but very knowledgeable journalists who've been in the region for decades and are convinced that there's a Israel-Hezbollah war coming, maybe soon. And and this it'll presumably be part of an Israeli attack on Iran if it happens. If it does, this time it'll be an all-out air war, which will probably destroy all of Lebanon. And Hezbollah seems to believe, and those who know about it seem to take them seriously, that they have now the capacity to devastate a good part of Israel. So maybe they'll succeed in destroying each other, or something like it. And it could be imminent, and it could be part of a much worse war involving Iran or even beyond. How imminent it is, we don't really know. So, for example, Iran has announced, as you may have seen, that they would send ships to Gaza to join the efforts to break the blockade. If that happens, you know, it's finished. It might turn into a nuclear war, which could spread without limits. We have a president named Barack Obama. If you take a look at his website, I don't know if it's still there, but the website that he put up in his primary campaign, explaining his policies and goals and so on, there's actually the word Lebanon is mentioned once. It's full of effusive love for Israel, of course, but the word Lebanon is mentioned once. Namely, he took pride in the fact that as a senator, one of the few things that he did was to co-sponsor a resolution in June 2006, a resolution which insisted that nothing be done to prevent Israel from achieving its maximal goals in its invasion of Lebanon, and that Iran and Syria should be punished for helping defend Lebanon from its attackers. I gave, of course, talks in Lebanon. One of them was on May 25th. May 25th, I didn't know this, happens to be Lebanon Liberation Day. It's the one national holiday in Lebanon. Schools are closed, businesses closed. What's it about? Well, it's about the fact that in the year 2000, the guerrillas, Hezbollah primarily, had finally succeeded in driving Israel out of southern Lebanon, where it had been holding territory for 22 years in violation of Security Council orders, with plenty of atrocities and massacres, actually included a number of invasions, including all of the Israeli figures who are regarded as heroic doves, Shimon Peres, Yitzhak Rabin, and others. But they finally left and withdrew in the year 2000. So this happened to be the 10th anniversary of the national holiday, Liberation Day. If you read the press coverage in Israel today, it's full of articles by military figures, other officials, Ephraim Snam, Moshe Arendt, describing how they made a mistake by withdrawing from Lebanon because now Hezbollah is, they don't talk about Hezbollah, now Iran is able to renew its aggression against Israel in southern Lebanon. In other words, what they were doing in southern Lebanon, driving guerrilla war against Israel, was aggression against Israel by Iran. And that's accepted in the United States. You all know about the flotilla. You know that Israeli helicopters flew over the boats, let commandos down from them. Where did the helicopters come from? Well, from your pockets, if you're taxpayers. Israel doesn't manufacture helicopters. We give them the helicopters with the purpose of carrying out war crimes. And that's not a joke. Just to give one example, in the first month of the, in September 2000, just about the time that Israel withdrew from Lebanon finally, in September 2000, the second Intifada broke out. The first month of it was September. It was right after Ariel Sharon had gone on that famous visit to the region of the Temple Mount, very provocative. And then the next day, Ehud Barak sent a big military force, which killed a lot of people. Then it broke out. In that first month, September, there were 70 Palestinians killed and four Israeli soldiers, the usual ratio. If you go back to the press reports, you find that Israel was using helicopters, meaning American helicopters, to attack civilian targets like apartment complexes, killing dozens of people. It was reported. What was not reported, however, and to this day is barely known, is that just as those reports were coming out about U.S. helicopters being used to attack civilian complexes, Bill Clinton made a deal to send the biggest consignment of helicopters to Israel ever, or at least in a decade. Black Hawk helicopters and spare parts for Apache helicopters, the attack helicopters. That came out right at the time that the news reports were coming out about using them to attack civilian complexes. It wasn't a secret. You could read it in the Israeli press, you could read it in the military journals, James Defense Weekly, you could read it in the European press. Amnesty International had a report about it, condemning it. Not a word in the U.S. press. Actually, one word. One small newspaper in Virginia had a reference to it. It wasn't that it wasn't known. It was all over the wire services. Editors were, in fact, approached, asking them why you don't run. Well, you know, that's the kind of contribution that we make to these atrocities, and will continue to. Obama's one of the more extreme in this respect, as in the example I just mentioned. Well, if that comes, that's one major war that may come pretty soon, maybe is likely to come. It's not the only one. The one that's more likely, in fact, is imminent any day now, is an attack on Kandahar in Afghanistan, second largest city in Afghanistan. It's been announced, it's not a secret, that the next major attack in Afghanistan is going to be on Kandahar. Well, the U.S. Army has published, taken polls and published them, so you can read them in the American press, of opinion in Kandahar. That's about 95% opposed to a military action, 19-1 by the tribal elders who've met, apart from poll, the same percentage say we don't want military action against our Afghan brothers, referring to the Taliban. Okay, that's the next one that's coming. You can guess what that's going to look like. The last attack, widely reported and heralded as a great victory, was an attack on Marja. Marja is a town, small town in the Helmand province where most of the insurgency is in the Pashtun areas. Marja was finally conquered after a couple of days of pretty bitter fighting. As you may have seen, a few days after that, the commander, I think Lieutenant General or something, forgot his name, had an interview in the press in which he said, we've got to revise our notion of enemy. He said, we were thinking we were going to drive the enemy out of Marja, but now we understand that the people of Marja support the enemy. So we've got to recalibrate and think some other way of talking about who the enemy is. This is very reminiscent of earlier counterinsurgency wars. In fact, you could have read the same in Pravda in the 1980s, and you could have read the same in the United States in the 1960s, where it was written. So for example, in, must have been 1965, the leading U.S. government scholar, Douglas Pike, wrote a book about the Viet Cong, Viet Cong is a derogatory term invented by U.S. propaganda for the National Liberation Front, the Southern Resistance. And he described how difficult the U.S. goals are going to be in South Vietnam. He said the problem we face is that the Viet Cong are the only mass-based political force in South Vietnam. And to try to confront them, say, by political means, would be like a minnow confronting a whale, our clients being the minnow, them being the whale. So therefore, the only thing we can do is to reconstruct the war so that it's not the kind they want, a political war, but it's the kind we're good at, a military war. So we prefer our comparative advantage, which is violence. And we have to do that because there's no other way to for a minnow to deal with a whale. And in fact, that's the main principle of the famous COIN, as it's now called, counterinsurgency doctrine, which is, you know, the wonderful new theory that we're supposed to be dedicated to. And yeah, if you're fighting wars in other people's countries, you're constantly faced with that. It's not the United States that invented it, or the Russians, or the British could have told you the same thing, the French, the Germans, in fact, as far back as you go, the Romans, for the Greeks. Well, that's the prospect we're looking at. And for whatever years I have left, I don't expect them to be different from the past 75 of consciousness, unless something very significant happens here, at least a willingness to face the reality of these actions. I'll stop there and turn to you.
So if you would like to ask a question or say something, raise your hand and you'll get a microphone.
Do you think that if Barack Obama is elected for a second term, you'll see him go more to the right?
He'll move even more to the right?
Yes.
Hard to know. I mean, take, say, George Bush. Bush's second term was considerably more centrist than his first term. First term was abrasive, aggressive, brazen. I mean, he and Colin Powell and the rest told Europeans, literally, you either do what we say or you're irrelevant. We don't care about you. We make history was one of their famous words. We don't care. You guys, the reporters, you can report history, but we make it. And they went ahead and made it, like in Iraq, for example. Term dropped U.S. prestige to its lowest point in history. The U.S. became one of the most hated countries in the world and feared countries in the world. And it led to quite considerable internal criticism right within the establishment. Well, the second Bush term was more moderate, moved more toward the center. They kicked out some of the most outlandish figures, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, a couple others. Couldn't get rid of Dick Cheney because he basically was the administration. But the others, a lot of the others went. And it was more of a familiar kind of what we call centrist administration. And Obama's pretty much following the policies of the second Bush administration. What he would do in the next term, if he has another term, I don't know how to predict. Depends on the world situation. You just can't tell. I mean, take, say, Kennedy. There's a lot of propaganda, is what it amounts to, about how if Kennedy had not been assassinated, what kind of wonderful things would have happened. He was planning this, that, and the other. He was going to get us out of Vietnam. He was going to make peace in the world, and so on. The evidence for that is zero. I mean, on Vietnam, for example, there's a massive evidence. And what it shows is he was sort of toward the hawkish end of the administration. I mean, he was willing to tolerate McNamara's proposals for slow withdrawal from Vietnam, but always with a qualification after victory. Never departed from that. So, yeah, after victory. And in fact, the people in his administration, like McNamara, who were the most committed to withdrawal, we know what they did when the situation changed. After there was a kind of period of optimism about victory in 1963, by 1964 it was clear that that was a fantasy. So then the war, then we get Douglas Pike and the policies that went along with it. And I don't see the slightest reason to doubt that Kennedy would have done the same thing. And political leaders operate within a pretty narrow framework, which is set by external factors, power systems of various kinds, mostly domestic concentration of economic power. And there's a difference between them. They're not identical. But I don't think that these differences are very predictable. So, for example, in many ways, Richard Nixon was the last liberal president. That's literally true, if you look at his policies.
I'd like to ask you what you see, whether the financial crisis has had any effect on the level of aggressiveness of the Obama administration.
Well, it's going to have some effect. Look at the famous we're now, the current propaganda is we have to be obsessed with the deficit. Okay, that's coming from people like the Peter Peterson Institute and others who are, just dying to get rid of Social Security and other benefits that they hate. So we have to concentrate on the deficit. Actually, it's a pretty dumb idea. You should have a deficit during a recession. You should have a bigger deficit to stimulate growth and so on, but put that aside. What's the deficit? Take a look at it. About half the deficit is military spending, which is going up under Obama. In fact, it's the most military spending of any president in his first term, not relative to GDP, but absolutely. Well, that's roughly half the deficit. So if anyone's going to deal with the deficit, they're going to have to do something with that. And of course, that would mean cutting back on adventurism overseas. The United States is spending approximately as much on the military as the rest of the world combined. And it's technologically far more advanced and going into areas that other countries can't even dream about and in fact are trying to prevent, like space, war using space for military purposes. And there's all kind of other grotesque ideas on the drawing board. Like take drones, which are the exciting new technology. There are now plans for developing drones with nanotechnology, which allows theoretically a lot more flexibility, and having them range from massive drones which can carry out vast destruction to drones for targeted assassinations, which have just been condemned by Philip Alston, one of the leading specialists on international human rights, down to drones which can get into your living room and kill particular tiny drones that'll be able to penetrate small living spaces and kill people suspected of this, that, or the other thing. Well, all of this is extremely expensive, and that's plus the 800 or so military bases around the world. And the Obama administration is very much committed to those. I mean, they practically overthrew the government of Japan just recently. It's a big country. Because the Prime Minister of Japan had been elected on a campaign promise to Hatoyama to close down the military base in Okinawa. The people of Okinawa have been struggling to get that base out of there for decades, and the Japanese government finally agreed to try to do it. But the Obama administration put its foot down with a major power play, and Hatoyama had to resign. That's an indication of how power works and what the plans are. So yeah, if there's going to be any effort to deal with the growing deficit, a serious effort, that's what it'll have to concentrate on. Now, it's not going to. Obama has a commission, as you know, that's supposed to deal with the deficit. But there's every likelihood that that commission, if you just took a look at the way it's constituted, is going to go after benefits like Social Security, which isn't an economic problem at all, but is hated by elites. They've been trying to get rid of it for years. although it's in pretty good shape fiscally. So they're going to go after that. They're going to have to go after Medicare benefits and so on. But nobody's talking about doing anything about the military, which keeps expanding. But yeah, that's going to be a constraint at some point. You know, you can't go on like that forever. Actually, the other half of the deficit is mostly medical expenses due to the completely dysfunctional U.S. medical system, which has not been improved in its most dysfunctional aspect by Obama's health care reform. I mean, health care reform had a few good things in it, but it didn't touch the main part, which is the incredible expense of the system. It's about twice the per capita expense of other of comparable countries, and outcomes are down toward the bottom. So, for example, Amnesty International just put out a report on maternal deaths, deaths during childbirth. The United States is worse than Greece. You know, I mean, it's despite twice as high per capita expenses as anybody. One of these global studies. Compared to many countries, among them Cuba and the United States. Cuba has approximately the same health outcomes as the United States at 5% of the expense per capita. Well, none of this is touched in Obama's health care reform. This is the only country in the world, where, as far as I know, where the government is barred by law from negotiating drug prices. They can do it in the Veterans Administration, so their prices are sort of reasonable, but Medicare can't do it. So, of course, drug prices are, you know, two or three times as high as anywhere else. Obama insisted on that. He made a promise to the drug companies that that wouldn't be touched over the objection of 85% of the population, according to polls at the time. All right, that's not touched. The privatized and virtually unregulated insurance basis for the system is extremely expensive, and that's not touched. In fact, as you know, Obama killed even the public option over the objection of probably two-thirds of the population. So these things are just, you know, that's holy territory. Financial institutions are far too powerful dominating the government for there to be any real progress on this, unless we move towards a functioning democracy. But what the point you make is correct. There is a conflict coming up between a financial crisis, which is going to stay. It's not going away. Unemployment's going to be very high for a long time. It's not just a financial crisis. It's a general economic crisis. Unemployment is extremely high. No indication that it's going to reduce. In fact, you know, the economists are now recalculating what's called the natural rate of unemployment. So, and they're calculating it up. Some are getting it as high as 7.5%. That means that should be normal unemployment, not too far from the official figures now. In the manufacturing industry, where the likelihood that jobs will come back is very slight, unemployment is at about the level of the Great Depression. So these problems are there, and how that's going to be combined with a massive global warfare commitment, that's not obvious.
You mentioned a very critical example of how the media largely fails to report on things like this, and I would like to ask you that to what extent you think the internet might change that picture for the better, but more importantly, as we just saw this great theater piece, to what extent you think art in general and theater in particular is doing a better job in reflecting critically on these things?
Well, what you just saw is a good example. How effective it is, I mean, a lot of people are putting out a lot of energy and effort into it. It hasn't been enough to turn things around. As I said, I've been through 75 conscious years, and there have been gains, you know, things have been done, but not enough to end the fact that we're in a permanent, that there's a permanent state of war going on in the world. Sometimes it's not us, sometimes we're not directly involved. And so, for example, right now, the probably the worst atrocities in the world are in Eastern Congo, and nobody talks about that. We talk about Darfur, which is bad enough, because there you can blame it on Arabs. Okay, that's a good topic. Eastern Congo, unfortunately, you have to blame it on Rwanda, U.S. ally, and on multinational corporations, which are hiring the militias that are destroying the place in order so that people like us can have a coltane in our cell phones and other such things. So we don't talk about those, though maybe 5 million people have been killed there in the last couple of years. And there are things like that happening all over, and all too often we're directly involved. So has it been enough? Well, obviously not. Has it been something? Yes, it certainly has. For example, the Iraq War, horrible as it was nothing like the Vietnam War, not even close. And a large part of the reason was there's just too much internal resistance here. In the case of the Vietnam War, there was almost no internal resistance. If you think about it, there was finally a strong anti-war movement, which had an effect, but those of you who are old enough to remember will remember that it was 1967, 1968. That's after about 5 years of war. The first several years of war, no protest. In fact, when there were protests, they were broken up violently with the applause of the liberal press. That didn't happen in Iraq, and it had some kind of an effect in keeping it down. It's commonly claimed that, you know, there's a lot of wonderment about why there's so much less protest against Iraq as compared with Vietnam. Just think back. At the time when the Vietnam War was anything like the Iraq War, there was no protest at all to speak of. Much higher protest in the case of Iraq, and it has a kind of an effect, obviously not enough of an effect, but something. So you know, more has to be done, clearly.
In the wake of the Free Gaza flotilla and the attack on it, certainly the Israeli government and the neocons here have made the interesting twist of demonizing Turkey, who I thought the U.S. was relying upon as an ally to help them extricate themselves from Iraq. So have you any thoughts as to where that's taking us?
Well, first of all, just one slight correction. It's not the neocons here. The other day, I occasionally torture myself by listening to NPR. I was driving home. That's not the neocons, that's the other end. I was driving home, I guess it must have been Friday, and was listening to the news, and they're all things considered. They have two commentators, for those of you who listen, David Brooks on the right and E.J. Dionne on what's called the left, and that's the spectrum. And so it came up with question. One of the questions, I think it was Friday, was what do you think about the flotilla, and the two of them outdid each other in tried to outdo each other in vociferous support for the Israeli action and how it was completely moral and justified, maybe not carried out very well, but certainly correct. If you look through op-eds, it's the same. New York Times has had a bunch of op-eds about it. Either they come from spokespeople for the Israeli government officials even, or else others supportive of them. The United States is kind of off the global spectrum on this. I don't read the whole world press, but from what I've seen in the world press, it's very angry about this. Even the kind of mainstream business press, like the London Financial Times, but not here. And it's not the neocons. Unfortunately, it's across the board. It's you're quite right about the going after Turkey. I mean, the thing has been reconstructed as if in accord with Israeli government propaganda that the real issue is that Turkish terrorists were attacking Israel. That's kind of like what I quoted from the Israeli press about how Iran is carrying out aggression against Israel and southern Lebanon. Yeah. Or, for that matter, Vietnam. Take Vietnam. It's an interesting case. In the early 60s, when it was the Liberal Democrats, you know, Kennedy administration, the line was that the United States is facing internal aggression in South Vietnam. That was Adlai Stevenson, the liberal hero, speaking at the UN. He says, we're facing internal aggression in South Vietnam. Kennedy called it an assault from within. That's what we're facing in South Vietnam. And that's a very, you know, it's a very typical component of imperial ideology. We own the world. So wherever we get attacked, and for Israel the same thing, and there are smaller domains, somebody's carrying out aggression against us, even if we're invading their country. And that's happening right at this moment, not just in the case of Turkey, in a much bigger case. You all know that the main policy, foreign policy problem that the Obama administration is facing, according to the analysts and commentators, is Iran, the threat of Iran. Well, exactly what is the threat of Iran? We have an authoritative answer to that. There was just a study that came out. It's called the Global Military Balance 2010. It comes out every year by the Institute of Strategic Studies. I think it's called an institute that's basically part of the U.S. government. They come out with an analysis of the global military situation. So, of course, they have a section on Iran. And they discuss the threat of Iran. What's the threat of Iran? Well, it turns out it's not a military threat. They point out that Iran has, its military expenditures are among the lowest in the region, and, you know, a minuscule fraction of U.S. expenditures. Furthermore, Iranian military doctrine, they point out, is designed to deter invasions, so to try to hold back aggression long enough so that it can move to diplomacy. That's their military doctrine. They say if they're developing nuclear weapons, it would be as a deterrent against military attack. So what's the threat exactly, this huge threat that we have to face? Well, it turns out it's a political threat, the usual kind. The threat is that Iran is what's called destabilizing its neighbors. How is it destabilizing them? By trying to increase its influence. It's trying to increase its influence in the countries that are its neighbors. And that's aggression because we own those countries. When we invade them, that's not destabilization. That's imposing, bringing about stability. Just read the reports. We're working to bring about stability in the countries surrounding Iran, and they're destabilizing them by trying to extend their political influence. So they're a real threat. They're also, the other threat is supporting terror. What is terror? Terror is Hezbollah and Hamas. Well, you know, whatever you think about Hezbollah and Hamas, it's pretty hard to call what they're doing terror. Hezbollah is a Lebanese organization. It's now being charged with obtaining weaponry to enable it to deter an Israeli invasion, U.S.-backed Israeli invasion, the kind Obama loves, as he told us on his website. That's terror. Hamas is trying to protect. Hamas took power in Gaza in an election. They were freely elected. It's the only free election in the Arab world, and they happened to win it. And as soon as they won the election, the U.S. and Israel immediately, you know, within days, stepped up and attacked on the Palestinian population to punish them for voting the wrong way in a free election. And that was the first act of terror. The next major act of terror was that was January 2006, was in June 2007 when they took power in Gaza, eliminating Fatah, you know, the Palestinian Authority forces. That's the way it's described. But if you look closely, that's not exactly what happened. What happened is that the U.S. and Israel, with the help of the Palestinian Authority, tried to carry out a military coup to overthrow the elected government. And they beat back the military coup. And that's when they took power. That's when the siege really stepped up. That's a U.S.-Israeli siege, of course. Well, you know, they're not a, I mean, I don't like them, frankly, and they do a lot of brutal and ugly things, but it's pretty hard to call that Iranian terror, you know. But that's the threat of Iran, supporting terror and destabilization. Well, you know, if you own the world, that's natural. So in South Vietnam, we faced internal aggression, assault from within. And in the case you mentioned, when Israel, with U.S. support and U.S. equipment, attacks a boat in international waters, killing people, a major crime, it's the fault of the people on the boat. You know, they're the ones carrying out the terrorism, Turkey in this case. And it's a tricky case, as you mentioned, because Turkey is a major ally. And how they're going to finesse this is not very clear, you know. It's, I mean, from Israel's point of view, apart from the criminality, it's sheer insanity. I mean, Turkey is their only regional ally and a close ally. It's been the second closest ally after the United States since the 1950s. And they use Eastern Turkey for military exercises. There's military bases there. They're a major military supplier to Turkey, and plenty of relations in the other direction too. And to alienate their one ally by an act like, by a criminal act like this, is profound irrationality, and one of many extremely irrational acts that they're carrying out in the last couple of years, which is pretty ominous, because it's a powerful state, and when it's overcome by paranoia and irrationality and hysteria, there could be real dangers.
I wanted to ask you a question about a totally different area, which is on the environment.
The environment.
Because of not only the oil that is leaking from the British Petroleum explosion, but the methane that is being released, and the methane is the worst heat trapping gas that there is. Do you think that people are going to start to wake up to how fragile our planet is, and that we can't sustain wars? In Pakistan last week, they had the highest temperatures they've ever had, 128 degrees, you know. So do you think this is going to, there'll be something good coming out of it?
Last year, as you probably read, was the warmest year on record. What's going on in the Gulf is horrible enough, but it's worth noting a real racist element in our concern about that. I mean, it's a fraction of what's happened in the Niger Delta, for example, where there are huge oil spills going on all the time, causing enormous damage, killing all sorts of people. But, you know, that's Black Africa, so who cares? I mean, it's not as serious as the oil spills in the Amazon by Texaco, now Chevron. So it's bad enough, but that's what we do all over the place, and nobody pays any attention. This time it's us, so you know, it becomes a big issue. Yeah, it's bad. And today, Obama announced more oil drilling. He's going to renew oil drilling. The methane is no joke. You're quite right. The permafrost melts in Siberia and other places, the predictions are it's going to release a huge amount of trapped methane, which, you're correct, is much more dangerous than carbon dioxide. And a lot of other, you know, I mean, these are kind of what are called nonlinear events. You know, that you can have a sudden spurt after things go, continue slowly in a certain direction. Will anything be done about it? Well, it's, I mean, we're facing the question of species survival in this case. It's kind of like nuclear weapons. But unfortunately, there are institutional factors that make it very hard to do anything. I mean, it's not that there are sort of bad people in control. The people who are making the decisions are trapped by institutional structures. So, for example, the major power center in the country, unquestionably, is the corporate sector. But if you're the CEO of a corporation, you don't have a lot of choices. You have to act so as to increase short-term profit, or else you're out. If you don't do that, first of all, it's required by Anglo-American law, so if you don't do it, it's illegal. But even apart from that, if you don't do it, you're kicked out and somebody comes in who does do it. Now, that's the nature of the system, you know, the semi-competitive system. Now, major corporations and business associations like Chamber of Commerce and so on, American Petroleum Institute, they've been carrying out large-scale campaigns in the last couple of years to try to convince the public that global warming is a liberal hoax. Okay, and it's succeeding. By now, the proportion of the public who believes in anthropogenic global warming, you know, human contributions to global warming, is barely over a third. It's declined sharply. So the propaganda campaigns have been succeeding. Well, you know, the CEOs who are carrying out those campaigns understand as well as you do that this is no liberal hoax, that it's going to destroy what they own and destroy the lives for their grandchildren. They know that as human beings, but in their institutional role as CEOs, they have to dismiss this as what's called an externality in economic theory, as something you put aside because it doesn't have to do with making the best market transactions. Well, in this case, the externality happens to be the fate of the species, but it's still an institutional requirement. And to overcome that is no small task. That means really reconstructing institutional structures in a large-scale way. And the limited market, it's a very limited market that we have, kind of compels those highly destructive decisions. I mean, it's the same in financial markets. So there's what's called systemic risk. You know, if Goldman Sachs, they make some transaction, if they're playing the game by the rules, and they have to, or else, you know, their guys are out, they carry out a transaction in such a way that it benefits them. And if it's a risk, they, you know, insure themselves against that risk. But they don't consider the effect on the rest of the financial system, what's called systemic risk. That's an externality. They ignore it. And it's built into the system that they must ignore it, even though it's understood that this is, you know, brings about repeated financial crises, worse and worse. Of course, that can be overcome by government regulation. From the Depression until the 1970s, when deregulation started and financialization of the economy began, during that whole period, there were no financial crises because the regulatory structure of the New Deal was sufficient to constrain it, plus the whole way the financial system was organized. But since the 70s, there have been repeated crises getting worse and worse. We're probably building up for the next one right now. Again, this externality is not accounted for. Well, in the case of systemic risk, there's at least an answer. The government can regulate sufficiently to overcome this serious market defect. In the case of the environment, nobody's going to do it unless God steps in. There's no one to control the externalities, the fate of the species. But that's what we're faced with. So it takes real work to try to do something about this. And how much time there is, we don't know. I mean, what we do know is the longer it's delayed, the worse it's going to be. How bad it'll be, you can just guess.
Barack Obama promised to close Guantanamo within a year of becoming president. He hasn't done so, and there doesn't seem to be any indication that he will. So I was wondering if you could address, one, whether we understand his political and legal reasons for not doing so, and whether you yourself see a type of solution, because it seems like the claim is that there is no solution.
Well, there's a solution. You can close it. But actually, the whole Guantanamo case is kind of interesting. What right do we have to be in Guantanamo altogether? I mean, Guantanamo was stolen from Cuba at gunpoint in 1902. The U.S. invaded Cuba to prevent it from liberating itself from Spain. In the history books here, it says we invaded to liberate them, but that's not what happened. The scholarship has wiped that out. We invaded to prevent them from liberating themselves from Spain. Among other things, we, at gunpoint, passed an amendment which required them to hand us Guantanamo, the main port and the, you know, the eastern part of the island. And there's a treaty with Cuba that they want to get out of, but we won't let them, which does have conditions on the use of Guantanamo. It's supposed to be a coaling station. There's nothing in that treaty that says you can use it to store Haitian refugees that you don't want, as was being done for a long time. Now, there's nothing in it that says you can use it as a torture chamber. So, first of all, it's stolen at gunpoint by a completely illegitimate treaty, and it's being used in violation of that treaty. And furthermore, the fact that it's a torture chamber was obvious at the beginning. I mean, I can't understand why anyone was surprised when the torture memos came out. I mean, why have interrogation carried out in Guantanamo instead of in a prison in New York? Well, there's only one reason. You can claim that American law doesn't apply. There's no other reason for it. So of course it was going to be a torture chamber, and it is. Now, it's not the only one. The Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan is probably worse. And if you look at the legal record, the Supreme Court did pass a decision overturned the Bush administration effort and ruled that prisoners in Guantanamo have habeas corpus rights. The Bush administration tried to restrict that to say, well, it just applies to Guantanamo, not to other interrogation centers like Bagram. But the district courts, in fact, a Bush appointee in the district court ruled that it applies everywhere. Okay, the Obama Justice Department is now trying to overturn that. They're trying to outflank Bush from the right on torture and try to get the courts to decide that it doesn't apply to, say, Bagram, which means, as Glenn Greenwald pointed out in a blog, that what that means is that if the United States captures somebody, say, in Yemen, and decides it wants to torture them, they can't send them to Guantanamo to be tortured, but they can send them to Bagram. Big difference, you know. That's Obama. You know, on the legal issues, it's not much of a record. There's a few things that are improvements over Bush, but not on the main ones. And this is an example. But there's no problem about Guantanamo. It can just be closed. Why should the United States be running torture chambers?
Where do the detainees go if we close Guantanamo?
Either you bring them to court and try them, and if they're guilty, in a fair trial, sentence them, or else you free them.
Their countries won't take them back, so where do you send them?
If their countries don't take them back, we should provide refuge for them. But that's what criminal trials are. Suppose you're arrested for something. You're not supposed to be tortured. You're supposed to be brought to trial, and if there's a charge against you, okay, the government tries to present it, and if you're free, you're free.
I think the whole point is that there are no charges against them.
Well, that's the problem. They don't have credible charges against them. If they did, they could bring them to trial. That's why Obama is in favor of military commissions, which don't have anything like the guarantees of fair trials. I mean, there's a claim, well, we're at war, and they're prisoners of war, or something like that. But, you know, that kind of a claim, anybody could make about anything.
Are we out of time, Sarah? Is this, yes. So there are three commercials before we end. Noam's book is outside for sale, and it's called, it has an optimistic title, actually. What is the title? Tell me the title of your book. Hopes and Prospects. That sounds good. So I think everyone should buy a copy. We have two more weeks of prophecy, and please tell your friends. We're not yet sold out. We would like to be very much. And thanks to Peace Action for creating with us this evening and this benefit. And they would like to say, and I would like to say, of course, that we should all take peace action in our lives and do whatever we can to change things. So thank you very much. Thank you, Noam.